I'm delighted to welcome with the Court with Class program students from West Allis Central. Could you please stand so we can meet you? Thank you. Will you be seated? And you are joined today by students from Sun Prairie High School. Would the Sun Prairie High School students stand? Thank you. We're delighted that you could come too. The Courts Court with Class program has won two national awards, I'm happy to say, and we are continuing this program for the year. The students have all received summaries of the case that we are about to hear, and there are additional summaries available outside the courtroom. Now that we have met you, I would like to introduce you all to the court. On my far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage. To his left is Justice Jeanine Geske, and at the far left of the bench is Justice Patrick Crooks. And with those introductions completed, I will call the next case, 96-2726, Gertrude Holka versus American Family Insurance Company. Representing the defendant appellant, Ms. Holka, is John R. Pendergast. Mr. Pendergast? Right, okay. You may proceed.
Before I get going, I have to attend to a little business to get the easel set up here.
All right. Divine, you have a copy of what appears at the easel. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, my name is John Pendergast. I'm with the law firm of Crivello, Carlson, Minkowski, and Steves from Milwaukee, and my client in this case is Catholic Mutual Relief Society. I'd like to welcome, in particular, the students from Sun Prairie High School. That's where I went to high school, out of coincidence, so I hope you'll say hi to my good friends back in Sun Prairie.
Why do you think it wasn't planned? Go ahead, counsel.
I'm already paranoid. As the court is aware from reviewing the briefs, and I've been admonished through your notice not to belabor the facts, but just briefly, my client in this case settled the claim of a minor, Justin Coldaway, who was a passenger in a vehicle being driven by American Families insured, and Justin Coldaway was sitting in a rear seat with an available shoulder harness, three-point belt, and was injured. My client settled that case and has brought this claim for contribution against American Family, who insured the driver for failing to make sure that the minor injured party was belted in the car. So that's, in essence, the issue before the court. American Family has taken the position that their insured should not have to contribute to this settlement, despite the fact that a stipulation of facts provides that 50% of the claimed damages of the minor plaintiff were in fact caused by the driver's failure to make sure that the passenger was belted.
So if this were a $500,000 verdict, you would, and there were no limits, or $1 million limits of American Family, you'd be asking for 50% of $500,000.
Approximately. I think the way we set up the facts was that we had discounted the judgment for the seatbelt negligence attributed to the passenger to make the numbers nice and round, but it comes out to about 50%, and that was the number I think I used in the brief without getting down to the nickels and dimes. But yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Just a question. Now, could the child have sued the person on its own? In other words, for failure to build them in?
Well, this gets to the crux of the issue. There is no Wisconsin decision which would hold that the minor could sue the driver. I think that the court should be aware that I think a necessary result of this court finding a right of contribution by my client against the driver would be the likely conclusion or inference that, in fact, the minor passenger could sue the driver for failing to make sure that passenger was belted. So that issue has not been decided by this court, and that is not the issue to be decided by this court, but is certainly really a necessary inference will be drawn if this court decides that I'm entitled to contribution. I think they'll have to find that minor has a right against the driver. And in fact, that issue, the only reported decision that we were able to find was cited in the certification to this court is from Wyoming, where indeed the Wyoming Supreme Court found just that a minor passenger does have a cause of action based on common law negligence against a driver who fails to provide or make sure that passenger is belted.
Your position is if we would follow Wyoming, I know it's not this case, then contribution has to be allowed. Is that right?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. Yes. Again, it will be only, at least our position is, that it would only be for the enhanced injuries due to the failure to use the belt. Now, there would be another issue that I don't think has been raised in this court is a question as to whether the contribution should be just for the enhanced injuries. Our position, it should be just for the enhanced injuries, but certainly if this court wanted to go back and take a look at Foley, and if that was the intent of this court, to go back and look at Foley to see if that issue should be revisited, the court could do that as well. I don't think anybody in this case has briefed that issue or is asking the court to change that decision, but there's no reason why that it couldn't be just a matter of pure negligence between all the negligent parties.
In your comment that the Wyoming case allowed for a common law negligence action by the child against the driver, do you think that there could be is there any legal authority to bring an action for violation of a safety statute as negligence per se? It's distinct from the common law.
In the Wyoming case, they did have a seatbelt statute. The statute itself provided specifically that it would not constitute negligence per se. As I recall, the key in the Wyoming case, however, was that they found that the statute was enacted after this event and could not have retroactive application to the facts in the case. So I guess to directly answer your question, I don't believe there's a case finding negligence per se because another state had passed a seatbelt statute. I don't know of such a case if there is one. It's our position that we are advocating a rule of responsibility for all people who are negligent. We feel the rule advocated by American Family is a rule of impunity for drivers of cars who fail to belt their children. In preparing for this, I guess, unfortunately, but coincidentally came up with a Johnny Cochran-esque type of analysis, and that is this. I thought of an example of a parent or a responsible adult responsible for a child, and the parent allowed that child to just stand in the middle of the street. We'd all agree that adult or parent would be negligent for allowing that child to stand in the street. But the American Family in this case is advocating a rule where if a parent allowed a child or an adult allowed a child to stand on the seat, they would be immune from liability. And my position is that standing in the street is no different than standing on the seat. And again, this unfortunately came to me quite unwittingly, but I felt that I would at least give that little tidbit to the court.
Are you so, lighten our day?
That's great. If you're the child, maybe not so great. But we're talking about a third-party contribution action here.
Exactly.
That's a different analysis.
It goes to the issue, though, of is the driver negligent? And my position is, one of the issues in this case is the driver negligent? First, we define contribution. Is the driver negligent? And American Family has said, no, the driver's not negligent. And so my position is allowing a child to stand in the street is no different than allowing the child to stand on the seat of the car, which we see every day. I'm sure each of you and I cringe when we see this happen. And I think to find the element of common law negligence, It does not take anything other than a reading of this court's decision in Rockwhite to find that this allowing a child to be in a car without being restrained presents a foreseeable risk and unreasonable risk of injury. So element number one, the driver of this car is negligent. We've also argued then that not only that there's a common law duty to do this, which we feel is clear again based on this court's recent decision in Rockwhite, but that the seatbelt statute itself creates a statutorily based negligence per se. The statute has been briefed is 347.48. The statute that was violated by the driver, in this case, American Families Insured, was what I'll call the seatbelt statute, which is 347.48.2M. Also contained within 347.48 is a sub 4, which pertains to child restraint systems, and I'll refer to that as the safety seat statute. The safety seat statute clearly says that a violation of that statute does not in and of itself constitute negligence. It's our position that because section 2M, the seatbelt statute, omits that language, that the legislature intended that that statute create negligence per se. In support of this, we have the plain language of the two statutes, one clearly saying this does not constitute negligence, the other statute not containing that same language.
Mr. Pendergast, which one came first?
The child safety seat statute came first. I believe that was a result of 1985 legislative session. And I believe the seatbelt statute, at least the language, and I'll get to that, arose in the 1987 session. Now, I will admit to the court a little problem with this case. And I was here yesterday to try and figure out what this was all about and to watch and listen to arguments. And this case certainly isn't as interesting as the case you heard yesterday afternoon. But it seemed to me in that case there were some procedural problems with the case, not to argue the case, but it seemed to get in the way of the heart of the case that the court struggled with. In this case, there is, a problem as well, and that is none of the parties in this case discussed the legislative history of this statute in their briefs that were filed in the trial court. Neither of the parties discussed the legislative history of this statute when the briefs were filed in the Court of Appeals. And it wasn't until the respondents filed their brief in this court that the legislative history was ever referenced. And I want to be upfront about that because I don't want to sneak something into the record or be accused of sneaking something into the record. The fact of the matter is, though, that the legislative history in this case has not been raised until the respondents filed a brief with this court. That's not to say that this court shouldn't look at the legislative history. And I think if there's some doubts as to what was meant by the legislature in passing that 1987 act, then we should look to legislative history. And that's what I propose to do with the materials you've been provided and with the posters I have here. But again, I want to acknowledge that this will not be found in my brief or will not be found in the appendix that was filed. I think the court has made clear in the past that on an issue, pure issue of law, particularly where here we have stipulated facts, the court will look at such matters. But again, I will fully admit that this matter is not in the record, if you will, before addressing it. The original bill, Senate Bill 7 from 1987, which gave rise to this language that's in the seatbelt statute, originally contained the exact same language that's in sub 4. This will not in itself constitute negligence, and that's what's on the board before you and in the materials that are before you. The bill passed the Senate and went to the Assembly. In the Assembly, there were 20-some amendments, and Amendment 18 was to change the language. And
do we have a microphone that he can use it, please?
My apologies.
Otherwise, you don't get taped. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. This was the, and I'm not, I know in reading your bios, a number of you served on the legislature, so you understand this process much better than I do, but this was the drafting request for the Assembly amendment. And the amendment was failure to wear seatbelt equals negligence. And as a result of that, the amendment, which you also have before you, was made to the Assembly bill, or to Senate Bill 7, which added the language that's now in the statute. That is the language that, after the reconciliation, there is in the legislative history, which is you don't have in front of you, there's a memo from the staff attorney saying the Senate bill says this, the Assembly bill says this, they don't agree, what are we going to do? And ultimately, the bill as passed contained the Assembly language, took out the Senate language, which said this should not in itself constitute negligence. We believe that aspect of the legislative history supports our position that violation of the statute constitutes negligence per se.
Counsel, let's say you're right. Let's say there's negligence. And like in the Rock White decision, we then get to a public policy determination. As I look at these numbers, we have a total damage of $588,000. Gartner, 70% of the 75%, totals $308,000 if you prevail. $308,000 out of a total of $588,000. Seems to me there's an argument that there's a little lack of proportion here. You look at the legislation, and it says, in a civil context, boy, if you violate this, you get the whopping penalty of $10. And the legislature has even spoken and said, look, a person can be negligent for not wearing a seatbelt, and there can be lots of damages and lots of negligence, but we don't want this to get out of proportion. We're going to limit it to 15%. So respond to the argument that even if there is negligence, that it, as a matter of public policy, we shouldn't allow recovery because one of the reasons it's set forth in Rockwright and its predecessor cases is that it's so out of proportion to culpability.
Your Honor, this issue, I went over the legislative history in this case, and it finally dawned on me that in reading the amount of resistance even to the original seatbelt bill, that people just don't like seatbelts. They don't like them. And so, in a way, and we don't like to wear them. And in a way, it has colored our view of how people who fail to wear seatbelts should be treated. If the public policy, if you don't like seatbelts, certainly it's easy to argue, well, someone fails to use seatbelts or fails to belt their child, so what? I don't like seatbelts anyway. But I think if we're looking purely from the standpoint of public policy, it's time. And I think the time is right now to say, you know what? We're done pussyfooting around with the seatbelt thing. People should wear their seatbelts. But what a better public policy than to say people should not only be responsible, adults in this case, adults should be responsible for those children in their cars, and we're not going to, I don't want to drive down the street another day and see a four-year-old child standing upright on that front seat of the car. And so I'm advocating a rule of responsibility, and that's what better public policy is there than to have people be responsible. Their acts of negligence.
But this is the issue. I think the policy, having some recall of Rockwhite, is basically that the driver, not the person that was in the car hit, was 100% negligent. In other words, your client hit the car and was 100% negligent. Now, the damage portion would find that the person that was sitting in the car and didn't, not themselves, but the person that was the adult, would be substantially more responsible in damages than the person that caused the accident. But for had your client not hit this car, there wouldn't have been any problem. But in your client was, as I recall, 100% liable. And that, to me, is part of the public policy question that we're looking at, is that a person who is passively negligent all of a sudden has much more liability than one who is actively negligent, the person who drove the car. That's the public policy. How do you respond to that?
First, I think that this court some time ago has decided that, and I have the quote from the Packowitz case, that there's no reason why a person who is 5% actively negligent should pay 100% where you have a 95% passively negligent party. This court has rejected the difference between active and passive negligence. I would ask, let's take a look at the opposite case. Let's take a look at the driver who's 100% at fault for driving his or her car into a telephone pole at 7 miles an hour. Completely at fault for the accident. The airbag deploys, breaking the neck of a child seated in the front seat. Well, are you going? Does the court feel that? I'm saying this rhetorically, of course. Does the court feel that because the driver hit the pole that the manufacturer of the airbag would not have to respond in damages? They're each negligent, and it's up to the jury to decide what percentages should be attached to each negligent party. So, again, I think your question, in a way, belies this feeling about seatbelts. Are seatbelts different? Is it reasonable? If it's reasonable to belt your children, it's reasonable. And failure to do it is negligent, no different than anyone else's negligence. And I think that your question kind of argues to this point of let's set aside seatbelts as something a different species of negligence.
But my question is basically on passive negligence has very little to do with seatbelts, because this is going to affect not only people that are belted in their car or not belted, but it affects other areas too. This is written just for this one issue.
I feel that our position follows from Packowitz, and it follows from Bielski, that negligence is negligence is negligence, and if you're negligent and you cause injury to somebody, even if it means you have to pay money, that you're negligent and should have to respond. And a rule of law that allows people to impugn themselves or absent themselves from that responsibility is not a good rule of law.
But counsel, had your Holka not been negligent, the child would never have been injured despite Gertner's negligence. Why should Gertner, let's assume she's paying it out of her own pocket, why should she, who had Holka stayed home that day, would not be liable for a penny? Why should she have to pay?
For the same reason that in the farm machinery case, the John Deere case, that the farmer who was 100% negligent for walking out and sticking his hands into a combine received damages. He was completely at fault for walking out there and sticking his hand in there. But the fact that the machine or any machine doesn't continue to have a guard, the manufacturer can be negligent as well. And there's no reason not to compare those acts. Both were negligent. One certainly put the ball in motion. Without one, you could not have the other. But they're still both negligent, and the negligence of both combine to cause the injury.
Counsel, there's a difference between comparing negligence and a cause of action and contribution. In your brief, and I'm looking at page 10 of your brief, you refer to this incident and describe it as successive tortfeasors. Justice Babbage's comment emphasized, in my mind, the successive nature of this situation. Yet the law in the state of Wisconsin is there's no claim for contribution for successive tortfeasors. That is the law. Why should, and that's what this case is all about, contribution. Why should we change, as I see it, the law to apply in this case?
If I said there were successive tortfeasors, I take that back and scratch that out of my brief.
Well, it's on page 10, second paragraph.
All right. I may have been discussing Foley's analysis and referring to it as being like successive tortfeasors.
In fairness, you say this.
Okay.
In a safety belt case, this means that the first tortfeasor, the person whose negligence caused the first collision, and the successive tortfeasor, the person whose negligent failure to properly restrain a passenger caused enhanced injuries in the second collision are jointly liable for the passenger's avoidable or enhanced injuries. So
that was inartful language to confuse successive tortfeasors with the temporal successiveness of the acts. This is not a case involving successive tortfeasors, and I think the cases cited in my brief and discussed indicate that even in a case of successive tortfeasors where you have the indivisible injury, you would have contribution. And again, I would ask that the court, in reading some of the cases, the Bielski case, in which the court went from having a contribution rule of 50-50 no matter what to allowing percentages of contribution, the court, and I thought with very eloquent language, pointed out the injustice of this 50-50 rule, just as here, I think there's an injustice in saying you cannot have contribution from this party because we have this rule that says you can't do it.
So, counsel, you're arguing for a rule that if I negligently maintain my sidewalk, I don't put sand on it during an ice storm, and then somebody injures somebody on my sidewalk, then they negligently reach out and cause injury to them, and the injury is enhanced because of my failure to maintain the sidewalk, I should be held liable.
I think that if someone can convince a jury, or if this, the issue before this court as to what your duty was to maintain the sidewalk, I assume you'd have one, and if someone say, well, this was enhanced by the fact that this property owner didn't do anything, you failed to exercise reasonable care, and it contributed to these injuries, I agree.
I suggest that the case given to you by Justice Babbage is very different than the case you have here because of the legislation. The legislature, and this was after our court said otherwise, the way our court set it up in an elaborate formula which attempted to take into account the original tortfeasor and reduce, but not beyond zero, the damages that were going to be paid or reduced by the negligence of the injured party. So Foley is a little different than this case because of the injured party, and different than the case Justice Babbage gave you, because the sidewalk case, because the legislature said in 47.48 2MG, notwithstanding 895.045, with respect to injuries or damage determined and caused by a failure to comply with B, C, or D, such failure shall not reduce the recovery by more than 15%. This paragraph doesn't affect the determination of causal negligence, and that's another aspect of the Foley case. And then under D, it said evidence that D relates specifically to children. Evidence of compliance or failing to comply with A, which is again seatbelt, is admissible in any civil action or property damage resulting from the use or operation of a vehicle. But failure to comply with paragraph A does not by itself constitute negligence. Now, don't you have here a specific policy by the legislature saying, hey, the amount of damages that's going to be caused by seatbelts is 15% max? And maybe if we sued the driver who failed to allow seatbelts, maybe she'd claim, if the child sued him, you can only sue me for 15% because the legislature says that's all you're entitled to.
If I could respond. The statute is very clear in its language that the 15% only applies to a reduction in damages.
Right.
The legislature meant what you, as you posited, they could easily have said that this could be admissible in court to prove negligence, but the negligence will never be more than 15%. That's not what they said. They conspicuously said the damages shall not be reduced. And I would argue that the meaning is just the opposite, that they specifically wanted to limit only damages, and that for the negligence for failure to comply with the sections which do relate to belting of children, they place no limitation on that at all. So I think the language of the statute argues just the opposite, that the 15% reduction is clearly limited to damages, and it does not limit the amount of negligence for someone violating the sections pertaining to belting children.
You can argue it really has nothing to do with your case at all, because it dealt with Foley, which dealt with a person who was injured failing to seatbelt himself or herself there. They weren't thinking about your case at all.
That may or may not be true. There's nothing in the legislative record to tell us what precisely they were thinking. I guess that would be true.
Are there any other questions? Okay, thank you, Counsel. You'll have time for rebuttal. Mr. Devine, you represent American Family.
Thank you, Judge, or Justice. As I see this case, it is the opportunity for the drunk driver who was completely responsible for causing an accident to foist on the innocent party the damage portion that he's created, and then to make that person responsible for what the drunk driver caused. The issue with respect to the matter in front of this court doesn't have anything to do specifically with the duty of the driver to the child. We have specifically avoided that in the way that we presented this, because I didn't want to be in front of you arguing whether or not a parent had a responsibility to their child concerning strapping them in to the seat. The issue here goes to what has the legislature done with respect to the thousands of pages that have been devoted to trying to regulate the impact of the failure to use seatbelts on its citizenry. Contrary to what Mr. Pendergrass told you, we started this matter with arguments concerning the impact of 347.48. In our appellate court brief, we talked about the legislative history of 347.48. We have consistently looked to that statute to see what impact it will have on this process. As we have approached the Supreme Court here, the issue has been crystallized through the certification that the Court of Appeals provides us. And I believe that the questions that have been asked here, in essence, get to the distinctions that need to be drawn between what happens when you fail to use a seatbelt, as opposed to slipping and falling on your sidewalk, or the products liability enhanced cases such as Farrell and Hansen. When you talk about seatbelt, and when you talk about the failure to use seatbelt, you have moved into a different area of concern. The Packowitz case, which has been cited here, was not an attempt to tell us that passive negligence and active negligence are not to be compared. Indeed, the Packowitz case talked about the old distinction that we used to draw in the law between commission and omission. Here we're talking about another sense of the responsibilities that a person has. And in this sense, it's the responsibility of the driver of a car with respect to the use of a safety device by a member of or a passenger in that vehicle. We have traditionally looked at that problem differently than we have looked at other problems. The Foley case is a perfect example of trying to come to terms with the concept that once you get into a vehicle and you drive, your primary responsibilities are to follow the rules of the road. If you have no accidents, then safety with respect to yourself in the vehicle isn't relevant.
Well, let me ask you about Mr. Pendergast's example of the airbag. Is it your position, then, that if a driver is 100% responsible for an accident and the airbag does damage, severely injures a passenger with a child in the front seat, that there can be no claim against the airbag manufacturer?
Who's making the claim? Is it the person who's hurt?
Does that make a difference?
I think that with respect to how you're going to allocate the concept,
well,
here,
your
yes.
position is that the minor... the injured child in this case could have made a claim against the driver?
I'm not arguing one way or the other. I am assuming that. Yes, I am assuming that the minor does have a right to make that kind of a claim with respect to the minor's injuries that were caused here, since on that level the minor is saying, listen, I'm 7 years old. Should have turned around and made sure that I had my seatbelt on.
Let me ask you that. So it's your position that the minor in this child in this case could have sued the driver of the vehicle and recovered the 50% of the damages that are attributable to the failure to put on the seatbelt?
I'm assuming that that's the case.
50.
I have not made any attempt to try to figure out what the impact of the statute would be on the cause of action that the child would have. In the abstract, I'm accepting the fact that the child may be able to complain that the driver didn't do something here that would have allowed it to be safe within the car.
Without a contribution claim, then, isn't the company just sort of standing in the shoes of the child to be able to recover that portion that's attributable to those damages, then?
No, the company is standing in the shoes of its insured that it paid on behalf. It's asking for contribution here. It is not picking up the claim of the injured party. It's saying, in equity, I ought to be able to offset my responsibility by somebody else's responsibility.
Well, let's just follow up on Justice Geske's example. Now the child is going to sue the two drivers. The driver who caused the accident, this is in the same lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
and the driver who failed to belt the child in. And you may have some negligence by the child, but we can forget that.
Sure.
All right, so the jury comes back and finds that as a result of the other driver, that was the sole cause of the accident, but the child was damaged $100,000. As a result of the negligence of the child's driver of failing to seatbelt, you've got enhanced damage of $400,000.
Right.
Puts us roughly into this case.
Exactly.
Okay. So the driver of the child's car is only insured for $100,000 and is otherwise destitute.
Sure.
And yet is liable for $400,000. And then you've got the driver of the other car, who's only liable for $100,000 but has a policy of $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got two tortfeasors. I mean, I think that's the case that Justice Gessie is giving it. You got two tortfeasors, and the child wants full recovery of the $500,000. Can't get it from the seatbelt negligent tortfeasor, and wants it from the other driver. I mean, that's what we have here. It's convoluted in the sense of its contribution case, but so.
I was following it until the point. Is the question that the negligent driver only has $100,000, but that the seatbelt driver, the one who didn't put the seatbelt, is $400,000, and he's trying to collect from
the million dollars
driver.
From the million dollars from the person who failed to belt them in? Yes.
Okay.
I assume that's the
question. That's the scenario.
Judge or Justice, the reason that I did not want to get into the argument with respect to the nature of the duty owed is that these are the exact kinds of problems that you are going to confront if you advance if that's the issue that gets addressed. Here the issue isn't whether or not the child can do it, but here the issue is what are you going to do with seatbelt when you have a defendant that wants something? Our suggestion is leave it the way it was addressed in Foley. Make it avoiding the consequences. Make it a defense available that says if the seatbelt isn't used, you get the Foley process, and then the statute applies, but that's it. And we don't go any further than that with respect to handling the problem from the defense in the case. Because we have a statute that tells us how that's handled. The legislature has stepped in and acted in that area and said, with respect to using it offensively as a defense, this is all you get. We've made those choices, and as a consequence, then this court doesn't have to come to terms with what do we do under these circumstances, what do we do under these circumstances. Here, it's just a matter of telling the defense, your right to use this is merely to avoid the consequences. And the statute has already provided us with the paradigm to do that.
The problem I have with that is you have to say why. And then once you start explaining why, that explanation has consequences in other comparable cases. We can't just close our eyes and say, okay, in this case, we're saying that. Then in the next case, we say something else that's contradictory. I mean, you've got a law, you've got laws that are a fabric, a total fabric.
And that's why I think the court has to be specific with respect to the issue present here, the seatbelt. It isn't enhanced injury. It isn't some of the other consequences that we talk about here. It's specifically seatbelt. We have a statute that's been passed that deals with this problem. It's interesting that the only reason that we are here is that the statute got passed. Had the statute not been passed, the Foley parameters would have been used. The jury verdict that was recommended back at that time asked the question, how much is attributable to your failure to wear the seatbelt? It would have been 75%. Boom. They would have been there. But then the legislature steps in and says, no, we don't like that effect. We don't want it to happen like that. We want to mitigate that. And they said, now it's only 15%. So the reason that we are here asking for contribution is that the legislature stepped into the process and said, we're not going to let it go that far. We're only going to let it go to here. And then you lose the rest of it. So that's why we're here.
What about what the legislature did as far as amending Senate Bill 7, the argument that Mr. Pendergast gave us?
The Assembly Bill that was pending at the same time as Senate Bill 7 has the language that we currently use in 347-48 2MG, I think it is.
2MG.
2MG. That language was the assembly language. Included in our appendix as, I think, Exhibit C, is the analysis of the difference between the Senate bill and the assembly bill, where they talk about the effect of the Foley decision. What do you want to do with the Foley decision? Are you going to use that to limit the impact or not? And attached to the exhibit, or attached to the memorandum, was the standard jury instruction and standard jury verdict that was used at the time to assess responsibility for seatbelt negligence. And the question was, how much is attributable to the failure to wear the seatbelt? It is the exact question that was asked here with respect to what happened for your failure to wear a seatbelt. 70%, or 75%, I think we agreed on. What happens with respect to that? Boom, down to 15%. That's it. You got the benefit that you were entitled to there, and that means the statute has acted. They purposefully included in the statute the concept of this affirmative duty that we talked about, sub B. It's in the statute.
If you take that position, then in the case where the child sues the driver of the child's car, then you have to argue that he's only entitled to 15% of the damages.
Whose damages are we talking about?
Child's.
The child's damages could only be 15%? I don't know that that's the case.
Okay.
I think that the child's opportunity to assert the claim, the court would have to contend with the responsibilities of balance there to see whether or not the legislative purpose in that circumstance was satisfied, and whether this statute necessarily was intended to involve itself in that consequence. There's no question in my mind that when the legislature acted in 1989, it acted intending to affect the defense that was available for seatbelts. There's no question in my mind that it intended to cover this kind of circumstance, because here it's asserted as a defense. Here they're saying, under those circumstances, it's a defense, it gets treated this way. That's the end of the question. You don't get to circumvent the responsibilities that we've already thrashed out by asserting now a claim outside of the parameters that were set in the statute. That's the difference, I think.
Counsel, I'm concerned with the scope of this case and the scope of what may be this court's holding. We've been talking about seat belts, and yet we address and throw language around like joint and several liability, initial tortfeasor and successive tortfeasor. I note at page 30 of your brief you say, appellants would like the issues to be determined as joint liability between the first actor and the second actor for the enhanced injury. However, if the court enters this morass and articulates themes of joint and several responsibility, it must do so recognizing the extended impact it will have, and then you give us a quote.
Absolutely.
Is the scope of our decision, if we were to hold, as your opposing counsel requests, are those themes of successor liability or joint liability or joint tortfeasors equally applicable in products cases, in malpractice cases, if we start... So, in other words,
yes,
the reasoning that we would apply here equally applicable to those.
I think that they would be. I'm sure that among the bar, if you were to articulate a contribution right here between activities that are clearly successive in the way that they came about, that you'd see an array of appeals that would be here suggesting that, well, this is a circumstance where we ought to have them all together, and this is another circumstance where we ought to have them all together. And even more concerning to me is with the change that's taken place in the contributory negligence statute, What do you do with all of these people in comparing them? If you head on down that road, you have opened up this door, and now at the trial court level, you're saying, all right, I not only want the person who's driving the car, but I want the service station attendant who put the gas in it that allowed it to go so fast, and I want any number of other enhanced injury kinds of concepts that you could invoke to be compared.
What change in the contributory negligence statute?
I'd suggest that when they changed the way it impacted, so we no longer have joint and several responsibility, where they take out the what we already referred to as the 1% defendant, he's gone.
Is that a new statute applicable to this case?
I don't know. I'm afraid, though, that if we venture into the process, you will certainly see, if you find these people joint tortfeasors, despite the fact that they have this distinct sequence that's taking place, you'll have someone else, other than me probably, but they'll be arguing that indeed, on a comparative level, I ought to be putting all of these people in together at the beginning, they're joint, they ought to be compared, they ought to be handled in this fashion. And you
but don't
are.
Don't we already have that with the enhancement of injuries? Don't we already have that with the enhanced injuries cases?
The way we've looked at enhanced injuries, and I want to make it clear, we've looked at enhanced injuries with respect to products liability, and that's been the only place.
Here, and seatbelts.
Pardon?
Seatbelts
to the extent that it's an avoidable consequence, absolutely. But with respect to making this affirmative asserting, we have the Farrell case and the Hansen case and those kinds of things. Enhanced injury there deals with the worsening of the condition as a result of the product's impact on what happens. So far, there hasn't been an issue with respect to the impact of the change in the law. On a practical level, I don't know that there ever will be, since there is rarely anybody else out there to compare the design to other than the manufacturer. The question that you always get in a products liability case is, did they improperly design it? The answer to that, yes. And as in the Farrell case, you can't compare the plaintiff to that because the plaintiff didn't have anything to do with designing the product. So in that process, at least so far, it hasn't been addressed, but it may very well come about.
Didn't the Toyota case involve the design of the Toyota car with too much space or something not padded?
Yes.
Between the two front seats?
Right.
No seat belt, the man was thrown forward and broke his neck in between the two seats.
Exactly.
Wasn't that a comparison because he didn't have a seat belt on as to what should be applied to the recovery?
There was a seatbelt aspect to that. It was the Foley process, and by the time the Toyota case was decided, they already had limited the impact of what was going to go on. And then that case went ahead on what are you going to do with the with this enhanced injury that occurred, and there was no consensus as to how to handle the problem. I don't want this case to become an enhanced injury case because it doesn't represent the kind of injury process that we've looked at when
Isn't
we're trying to
Isn't it already an enhanced injury case? I mean, that's what was submitted to the jury. What injuries were attributable to the pure negligence of the other driver, and what injuries were enhanced by virtue of the failure to put the seatbelt on?
Yes, but that's the question that you have always asked with respect to seatbelts.
Well, I know that.
If you begin to use the analysis that has been adopted with respect to products liability and enhanced injury, you lose the distinction between what happens in a seatbelt case and the public policy decisions that we've already made with respect to products liability. We've determined that's something that's going to be handled in a specific way.
Let me ask the question differently. If you were going to write this case and hold for your client, which is no contribution, right?
Right.
How would you write it? What theory would you use?
I would use the fact that the legislature has acted with respect to using seatbelts as a defense in a case. They have adopted a paradigm in 347, 48, which says you apply it this way. It gets done in this fashion, and this is the only benefit you get, defendant, if you raise seatbelt as a defense. And because the legislature has acted, because it's already adopted it, and because the only way the contribution becomes an issue here is that that statute limited the way we could address seatbelt at the trial level, the statute prevails, and there's no right to contribution.
And the reason you're doing that and you're staying away looking at the three elements of joint tortfeasor is because you want to avoid all these other problems.
I want to avoid those other problems, Justice Abramson. And I also have a hard time with the old distinctions that we're trying to draw here when we talk about duty, when we talk about how it comes about, when we talk about how it ought to be applied. Those kinds of concepts are best used when that issue comes to you and they say, all right, does the child have the right to do this? And that matter will then be here and you can make your policy determinations or your factual determinations on that. This case doesn't need that and shouldn't get there. It opens up huge doorways of problems with respect to a long history of decisions that this court has made. If we begin to make them joint tortfeasors or if we begin to analyze them in that fashion, we now have really courted a tremendous level of additional scrutiny that I don't think is really demanded of the facts that we have in this particular case. So I think that if we use that process in understanding that seatbelt has occupied within the way that we've looked at problems a different kind of throne than other issues have, and that the legislature has acted directly here to try to deal with this problem and has acted repeatedly over time in an effort to do it, that this court's direction should come from the fact that the legislature has stepped in and addressed the problem. In that fashion, then, the legislature's decision here concerning what impact does this have for this defendant's rights has already been determined, can already be applied, and we can get a result that's consistent, then, with the way that the legislature has already decided it ought to happen.
And you would not even then, if you were writing it, discuss the concepts behind contribution.
I think that this case needn't go there. You can certainly, with respect to the way that it gets handled, find that there are distinctions to be drawn on this issue with respect to how contribution has been looked at in the past. Seatbelt involves an act that happened before the accident happened. Its consequences occur after the accidents happen. It is dependent on an activity that is clearly responsible for causing the accident. You can apply the traditional law that we've had in this state that says you don't get contribution from successive tortfeasors, and you can craft your decision to address those problems and to come to the same conclusion. I'm suggesting that that's a much trickier road to work through in light of Prosser's indication to us that concepts of joint liability and joint and several liability are things which have traditionally not been well defined. With the Butzow case itself that talked about how are you going to deal with concepts of joint. They're clearly not joint tortfeasors because something happens one after the other. Are they entitled to contribution because of that? I found that in looking at this case, if I took the step back and said, listen, contribution is an issue of equity. It's an issue as to whether or not someone is entitled to receive something that, despite the fact that they participated in causing this.
Let me interrupt a minute. Let me take you back to this, the analogy involving the airbag. And you have a driver who negligently runs into the tree. I guess that was the example Mr. Pendergast gave. 7 miles an hour would probably have caused no injuries or just minimal injuries, and the airbag goes off and the person becomes a quadriplegic with $5 million worth of injuries.
Okay.
And let's assume that the plaintiff happens to be a multimillionaire and pays out of his or her own pocket the $5 million. Your position is that that person could not sue the airbag company for contribution?
No. Airbag, under those circumstances, would be a products liability question. and as a products liability question, would be a different view of the circumstance. Here we have seatbelt. Here we have the statute. Here we have a whole set of rules that have already been developed.
And the reason there ought to be a difference between the negligence in a product liability case and the negligence that's not a product liability case is?
Statute. We're there.
But the airbag doesn't have a... We're not talking...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, the airbag is a defective... I mean, the vehicle with the airbag...
Why is there a distinction between the negligence of a products liability case and the negligence that is not a products liability case, is my question. Why is there that line? You said, yes, you could sue for contribution because that's a products case, and I'm asking why it makes sense to allow contribution when there's negligence because of a products case or responsibility because of a products case and not when there's simple negligence.
Because we have the statute in place that says that the impact of it is...
Not in the airbag case. I'm giving you the airbag case.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question.
Okay. The question is, why should those be treated differently? You said the driver who drove 7 miles an hour should not be able to sue for contribution to the manufacturer of the airbag, and the reason is that it's a products case. And my question is, why should there be a distinction?
I'm sorry. You misunderstood what I said. No. In that circumstance, the driver may very well be able to assert the claim for the products liability that arose because of the faulty airbag.
Okay, so this exception or this rule on contribution, you're tying only into seatbelts.
Exactly. And it's because we've already been there and done that we have the way to handle it. And because we have that process already in hand, we've got the legislature that has already acted.
Let me take you back to Justice Babbage and his sidewalk then. That's not going to help Justice Babbage. When he gets sued for contribution, your
no,
turn. Okay.
Unless I get the legislature to pass a sidewalk.
Unless there's some other reason to head in that process. So with respect to the issues that we've got present in this case, this matter is brought by a defendant who is causally negligent for having caused an accident. The claim is that seatbelt liability ought to exonerate that person's financial responsibilities and limit the impact that has occurred. Seatbelt has traditionally been viewed as an avoiding the consequences process rather than an affirmative injury-producing behavior. The causally negligent driver should not be protected because this safety feature, which has been the focus of an enormous discourse in our society, wasn't used. And in fact, in this particular case, we have thousands of pages of legislative history that are concerned with the very issues that we've been talking about here, and the legislature has passed a statute which applies to this circumstance and has application under these set of facts. The legislature, having operated and having limited the impact with respect to the use of a seatbelt as a defense in a case, ought to be accorded the responsibility of having thought it through and made the appropriate decision. This court should not disrupt what the legislature has done.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Pendergast, you have several moments.
Thank you, Your Honor. Part of the problem I've had with this case is that the respondent throughout, and this was pointed out, has failed to confine their argument to some kind of legal framework. And I think hence the question of, if you were writing the decision, what would you write? And I think what I just heard the respondents say is that the seatbelt statute was intended to just occupy this entire area of law, and so stay out of it. We're already there, so get out. The respondent, however, has never argued that the seatbelt statute was intended to abrogate any aspect of common law other than that one element of Foley. In fact, they argue exactly that in their briefs, is to say all that was intended was to abrogate Foley and limit the reduction in damages to 15%. There was no intent by the legislature to completely abrogate all common law of responsibility. Here,
but you know, when they limit damages to 15% after they allow a finding of negligence, the whole system is in disrepair.
Well, I don't think so.
Tell me how you would write the opinion.
Well, I think I'd write the opinion like I wrote my brief.
Still like the brief.
I think I'd still go with that.
With the one amendment, right?
With the one
Francis amendment.
Exactly. With the one amendment, with the successive tortfeasor thing, getting that out of there, I would stick, and I tried to stick with the analysis that I thought was appropriate. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, you go to the elements of a contribution claim.
Absolutely. I would stick to the elements of contribution, and I would deal with the questions of contribution. Was there negligence? I think a common law, certainly there is, based on Rockwhite. I think the public policy is in favor of adults taking responsibility for...